Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We begin our program, as always, with the latest on health and healing. This comes from Oregon State University, published in the peer-reviewed Nutrients. And it simply says that if you were to take a multivitamin and mineral supplement each day, that would be very important for your overall health, especially if you're over the age of, let's say, 50. Men in particular need more than the nutritional content provided by their diets to maintain healthy levels of important nutrients. The study included healthy men, ages 68 and older, who received a multivitamin mineral supplement or a placebo for 6 months. With the exception of those who had been prescribed vitamin D to treat deficiency, the men did not use nutritional supplements for 2 months prior to the study period. Lipids, metabolic markers, hemoglobin, A1C, ferritin, an indicator of iron status, vitamins A, B6, B12, D, E, K, folic acid, and the carotenoids like beta-carotene, lutein, and lycopene, calcium, copper, magnesium, zinc, and oxygen consumption by a type of white blood cell known as monocytes, which is an indicator of cell function and health, were measured at the beginning and the end of the study. At the end of the study, test results showed that those who took the multiple vitamin and mineral each day, and this was not a high-potency one, just a normal one, improved in several nutritional biomarkers, and that's important. So this challenges the old canard that, well, you can get all the nutrients you want from just having a good diet. Well, what is a good diet? For 93%, more or less, of the American population, a good diet is having fried chicken, French fries, colas, pizza, yeah, hamburgers, lots of bacon, lots of refined carbohydrate. That's a good diet, but it isn't. In fact, we are so polarized in the disinformation that we get on a regular, daily, hourly basis in the media that the average person has been indoctrinated to believe that what is producing disease actually promotes health, and it doesn't. We have hundreds of thousands of studies in the Library of Medicine, from peer-reviewed journals, showing the importance of each one of these nutrients and super-functional foods. So, this just gives you a heads up. You can help yourself in a lot of ways, a simple multiple vitamin, whatever one you choose. Back in the 1970s, there was the first of the superfoods. It was called spirulina, S-P-I-R-U-L-I-N-A. And this was grown in Mexico at a lake, and it's an algae, single-cell algae. And it was supposed to be the great detoxifier, help cleanse the body of heavy minerals and metals. So if you had cadmium, lead, mercury, it could help take it out of the body, or so that was what was claimed. And over a period of about the next 5 years, it grew in popularity. Now, according to Charles University, which is in Prague, the Czech Republic, studies in the last decade have shown that the regular consumption of spirulina can enhance brain function, improve white blood cell count, stimulate antibodies, boost liver health, and much more. Spirulina can also help remedy almost any nutrient deficiency due to its incomparable concentration of vitamins and minerals. Now, where was this published? In the Annals of Hepatology, the official journal. Well, okay. And it's giving us another reason to use spirulina. It contains an awful lot of bioactive compounds that can help treat one of the most aggressive and feared cancers of all, pancreatic cancer. And the Czech researchers sought to determine the anti-cancer effects of spirulina when they realized that it contained large numbers of a compound called tetrapyrroloic compounds, a class of chemicals that are closely related to cancer-fighting antioxidants. So consequently, they decided to test the effects of these compounds, specifically a chlorophyllin, which is in spirulina, on both human and pancreatic cancer cell lines in mice that were suffering from pancreatic cancer. All the test subjects were treated with one of the following doses, 0.6 grams or one of spirulina. And what they found was that they were monitored, and after the test was over, The results were undeniable. Compared to the placebo or control group, virtually all of those treated with the spirulina compounds demonstrated significant anti-proliferative activity from the spirulina, so proving to be the most effective of all the compounds. Quote, in conclusion, spirulina and its components substantially decrease the proliferation of experimental pancreatic cancer, end quote. I'm completing over the next couple of days what I hope will be the most definitive research paper ever produced on the impact of 5G and higher and lower electromagnetic fields. Now, we have been propagandized to believe that this is great. Everybody wants 5G. They should have it in all their devices because it connects you to everything. And not once have you seen a cautionary note of saying, first, do no harm. How do we know that the electromagnetic pulses are not causing a hypersensitivity? Now, as a person who has spent my life counseling people, I can tell you that since the advent of 5G and its popularity, and especially smart meters and all the antenna, I'm seeing many people suffering from electromagnetic hypersensitivity. Then you just have to look to see, is this just my own subjective experience? No. Trent University, which is in Ontario, found the same thing. In fact, they said, if your blood sugar is high, that alone can be caused by electromagnetic hypersensitivity. According to Trent University, the experts believe that the shocking epidemic of type 2 diabetes is being driven by lifestyle factors, primarily obesity, inactivity, those are the two, stress, a very poor diet, which counts for a lot of diabetes, because I've been able to reverse diabetes in virtually all the people I've worked with, providing over a period of 3 to 4 months, they stuck with a protocol. Just finished doing that just last week. Person who had uncontrolled diabetes, their fasting blood sugar level in the morning with no food was at 205, and then it went up from there. And today it's at 68 normal all day. Now, they're exercising, they're doing the right diet, stress management, and proper supplements. But that's just, it's not difficult if you know what you're doing. But what if you're the average person, you don't know what you're doing? And then you end up with diabetes, and you end up with diabetic neuropathy, then you end up with gangrene, and then you end up losing toes or foot or a leg or your life. Now, then there's also type 1 diabetes, which accounts for only about 5 to 10% of all diabetes. It appears to be largely determined by genetics. But evidence is accumulating that hypersensitivity to electromagnetic fields can cause high blood sugar, and raising the possibility that a third form of the diabetes, diabetes 3, could be caused by environmental pollution. Case studies show that high blood sugar is triggered by exposure to what we call dirty electricity. According to a peer-reviewed research study conducted by Dr. Magna Havas and published in the peer-reviewed journal Electromagnetic Biology and Medicine, quote, dirty electricity, or what is called transient electrical fields, can affect blood sugar levels in diabetic individuals who are electrically sensitive. And by the way, she's an associate professor of environmental and resource studies at Trent University. And she presented the case studies showing that plasma glucose levels increase in response to electromagnetic pollution. So just suggesting that we have another field that we should be looking at to help people. Now, another study, this one from the University of Buffalo, exercise mitigates genetic effects of obesity later in life. Now, we know that being overweight is deadly. Being obese is really deadly, and being excessively obese or morbidly obese is a killer, and no one's going to get by that. Now, that is not to suggest that anyone should shame themselves or accept low self-esteem because at that point in their life they're overweight. The idea is to put your energy into losing the weight in a healthy manner by changing all the unhealthy lifestyles and mindset to healthy ones. Well, new studies suggest that women over the age of 70, if you work out, you work up a sweat, you can reduce your influence of your genes on obesity. Quote, the message here is that your genetic risk for obesity is not wholly deterministic. The choices we make in our life play a large role in our health. This was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause, and it includes researchers from the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center, University of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, Rush University Medical Center, University of California, Davis, and Ohio State University. They studied 8,206 women of European ancestry who participated in the Women's Health Initiative. They used a larger set of 95 genetic markers, and that's what they found. So the older you get, the more you should exercise. New research shows that we have in our body genetic determinants, and that means that those are able to interact with heavy metals and get them out of the body. Many genes are known to be connected to metal resistance, but the group focused on those that enable bacteria to convert dangerous mercury to less toxic forms and absorb the heavy metal. So, just suggesting, have your probiotics, healthy probiotics. In this case, it was Bacillus magnanimus. So the takeaway message is this. When you're eating a healthy diet, include fermented foods like yogurt, sauerkraut, low-sodium sauerkraut, of course, a beet juice, all right, apple cider vinegar, or just take some strains of the lactobacillus, and there are multiple strains, and you can buy them in a health food store, all right? And by the way, all the things I've been saying all last week on the program about how the one thing that will determine how long you live is exercise. Stanford University just today brought out a new study, how the body responds to exercise at the cellular level. And researchers have long been fascinated by the possibility that exercise causes various cells in our body to produce molecules that benefit human health. And this was proven by a professor of pathology. And if these molecules, which are sometimes called exercise factors or exerkinins, can be identified and harnessed, then the theory goes they might reduce the incidence of certain health problems like obesity, heart disease, and diabetes, as well as improve athletic performance. And so his team got to work on this, and they found that's absolutely true. So the takeaway message is this. I won't go into the biochemistry, it's a little complicated. But this is not complicated. Go for a power walk each day. Try to get, ideally, 15,000 steps in, and half those should be vigorous, meaning really moving, or jog, or bike with the tension up so it's really hard to pedal for a half hour. You do that, and then lift some weights, do some resistance exercises, you're going to have a longer lifespan. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and healing. And remember, every day I do a classroom on the air. These are free, and they're about human nature. They're about health. Every topic imaginable I deal with. And go to Gary Nall YouTube, or you can go up on GaryNall.com, Odyssey, Rumble. I've got them all over the place. And enjoy the material. And for the latest on everything, go up and sign up for the Gary Nall newsletter. And it's power-packed with information and articles and stuff that you normally wouldn't be able to get because there's just not enough time for me to do everything on the air based on all the research I do every day. All right? Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. Now, what will be a lot of in-depth, original investigative reporting this week and next week. The report today comes from some deep scholarship, thousands of hours of research. Richard Gale, our scholar in residence, and myself. We read every article we could. We didn't start off with a premise where there was any bias. We were simply looking for the facts. Are the drugs that were FDA-approved off-label drugs available at the beginning of COVID, were they able, by documented proof, clinical experience, or epidemiological evidence, to have prevented a person from aggressing towards disease, hospitalization, and death? Because the mainstream media, in unison, along with governmental agencies, condemned the use of ivermectin or any other treatment. We were told to go home, quarantine. If we were sick, when we could not be at home any longer, then you check yourself into a hospital, go to the ICU, in all likelihood, intubation, to be able to breathe, and then one drug above all else was used and recommended by Anthony Fauci, remdesivir. We have more or less over 950,000 physicians in the United States. We have millions of nurses. We have millions of scientists. We have thousands of people at the technocratic and bureaucratic level of the government in the FDA, CDC, U.S. Public Health Service, and the World Health Organization, all of whom agreed with this approach. The mainstream media harassed and hounded people who suggested otherwise. Do you remember when Joe Rogan was attacked for suggesting that one of many things that he was recommended to take by his doctor was ivermectin? So here is the information. We have a lot of lawyers in our audience. I hear from them on a regular basis. We have people in this audience, including friends of mine, who took all their vaccines as they were told to, who also took boosters, some as many as four, and even in some cases five. No one seemed to complain at the official level. Some isolated parents did about giving the vaccines to their children. We were told, in fact, I was told by people at Pacifica's local station board, get behind Anthony Fauci, get the vaccines, don't use any of this other nonsense. Okay. But they were wrong about everything. Today we have irrefutable proof that they lied about everything. Did they lie out of innocence, not knowing any better, or was there some deeper agenda? I'm going to share our research now. If you believe that it is accurate, objective, and important, then send it over to Joe Rogan. Send over Jimmy Dore, send over to Glenn Greenwald, send it to Tucker Carlson, and send it to your legislators and ask them, would they convene a hearing in the House? It'll never happen in the Senate because Chuck Schumer wouldn't allow it. But in the House, there are committees going on now that have been forbidden for the last 16 years, and this should be one of them because the title of the article says it all. It'll be posted on GaryNall.com today. Ivermectin could have saved millions of lives. Why was it suppressed? Now, for those of you who are old enough, and those of you who have a good sense of history, especially in investigative journalism, go back to when Robert Houston, a close friend, outstanding researcher, we took upon ourselves a story that had never been written before in any national publication, the suppression of alternative cancer therapies. Took 5 years. The article was later published into a series of 58 different articles called Medical Genocide. It ended up being a special on 60 Minutes on Dr. Lawrence Burton and won two Emmys on 2020 under the supervision of Judy Moses, the executive producer. And I have tapes of all the conversations I had with everyone, in close anyone decides that, well, it really wasn't that way. Yeah, it really was that way. You want to get into an argument? Then listen to yourself on tape. In any case, we uncovered the cover-up, and we excoriated the American Cancer Society, the American Medical Association, all the major medical institutions. I give you that as a little background because it's time that the average American either accept that they do not have the capacity or the desire to question authority and will do whatever they're told, and those who only believed authority because they did not have other people in their lives, other authority figures, who had the scholarship to do the homework that they possibly weren't feeling comfortable doing. Most people are not medical doctors, and most medical doctors are not research scientists. Most research scientists are not clinicians. So any person can, with plausible deniability, say, well, it just wasn't in my expertise. I have too many other things I was looking at. But we looked at it all, and we interviewed hundreds of specialists. This, then, is what we found. In 2004, the U.S. Congress passed an amendment to the Federal Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act, known as Emergency Use Authorization, or EUA. This piece of legislation legalized an anti-regulatory pathway to allow experimental medical interventions to expedite without proper safety regulations and evaluations in the event of bioterrorist threats and national health emergencies, such as pandemics. In the time, and that was at that time, keep in mind, passage of the Emergency Use Authorization Amendment made sense because it was partially in response to the 2001 anthrax attacks and the U.S.'s entry into an age of international terrorism. However, the amendment raises some serious considerations. Before the COVID-19 pandemic, the EUA, the Emergency Use Authorizations, had only been authorized on four occasions: the 2005 avian H5N1 and 2009's H1N1 swine flu, the 2014 Ebola, and the 2016 Zika viruses. Each of these pathogen scares proved to be false alarms that posed no threat of any pandemic proportions to Americans. The fifth time the EUAs were invoked was in 2020 during the COVID-19 pandemic, which seemed far more plausible than previous emergency use authorizations. Before the government can authorize a EUA to deploy an experimental diagnostic product or drug or vaccine, certain requirements must be fulfilled. First, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services must have sufficient proof that the nation is being confronted with a serious life-threatening health emergency. Second, the drug or drugs and or vaccines under consideration must have sufficient scientific evidence to suggest they will likely be effective against whatever particular medical threat we're faced with. Now, despite being insufficient, the evidence must at least include preclinical and observational data showing the product or diagnostic test or drug or vaccine targets the organism, disease, or condition. Third, although the drug or vaccine does not undergo a rigorous evaluation by the FDA, it must at least show that its potential and known benefits far outweigh its potential and known risks. In addition, the product must be manufactured in complete accordance with standard quality control and safety assurances. However, when we are honest and not political, not ideological, and we look back at the government's debacles during the COVID-19 pandemic, two other EUA's requirements should be spotlighted. On the one hand, an emergency use authorization cannot be authorized for any product or intervention if there's an FDA-approved alternative product already available, unless the experimental product clearly shows to have a significant advantage. Moreover, and perhaps more important, the emergency use authorizations demand informed consent. I repeat, everyone who receives whatever the drug or vaccine must have a complete understanding of what they're taking into their body, what the science at that point knows or suggests is the benefit or limitation or possible side effect. Every individual who receives the drug or vaccine must be thoroughly informed about its experimental status and its potential risks and benefits. Recipients must also be properly informed about the alternatives to the experimental product, and nobody should be forced to take it. One final emergency use authorization requirement is that there must be robust safety monitoring and reporting of adverse events, injuries, or deaths potentially due to the drug or vaccine. This is the responsibility not only of the private pharmaceutical manufacturers, but also the FDA, the physicians, the hospitals, the pharmacists, the nurses, the clinics, and other healthcare professionals. Obviously, there are important cautions to be considered after reviewing the emergency use authorization requirements and the dangerous implications if they are not properly followed or at worst abused. Foremost are the inherent health risks of any rapid response of experimental medical interventions, especially novel drugs and vaccines, especially those that have never been used before. As we observed during the FDA approval process and rollout of the Pfizer and Moderna's RNA COVID-19 vaccines and Johnson & Johnson's adenovirus vaccine, no long-term human trials were conducted to even estimate a reliable baseline of their relative efficacy and safety. But perhaps equally important, the public should only place their trust in these emergency use authorization approved experimental drugs and vaccines if their evaluation by federal health authorities is conducted in a manner that is completely transparent and takes every potential ethical challenge into consideration. However, these cautions were categorically ignored and transgressed in every conceivable way. Moreover, conflicts of interest plagued the entire emergency use authorization review process. Most egregious was that Anthony Fauci at the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Disease and other federal officials had full knowledge that other FDA-approved drugs existed that could effectively treat COVID infections without the side effects. The antiparasitic and antiviral drug ivermectin best stands out. Ivermectin was first introduced to the market in the early 1980s as an antiparasitical drug for veterinary infections. However, its effectiveness was observed to be so remarkable and multifaceted that researchers started to investigate its potential for treating human diseases. In 1987, the FDA approved ivermectin for treating two parasitic diseases, including river blindness, in humans. And since then, an enormous body of medical research has grown, showing ivermectin's effectiveness for treating other diseases. Its broad-range antiviral properties has shown efficacy against RNA viruses, for example, avian influenza, Zika virus, dengue virus, HIV virus, West Nile virus, yellow fever, and earlier some respiratory coronaviruses. It has also been found effective against DNA viruses such as herpes, polymyvirus, circovirus 2, and others. The drug is capable of modulating a host of immune responses during viral infections and reduces pro-inflammatory cytokines, which contribute to viral tissue damage. Unsurprisingly, its discoverers, Dr. William Campbell and Satoshi Omura, were awarded the Nobel Prize in 2015 in Physiology and Medicine. Ivermectin was not a drug simply hidden away in a back closet. Rather, it had been prescribed to hundreds of millions, if not billions, of people over its lifetime worldwide. Given its decades-long record of in vitro efficacy, it should have been self-evident for Fauci and the CDC and the World Health Organization to rapidly conduct in vivo trials to bring ivermectin into becoming a first line of defense for early-stage COVID-19 infection and for use as a safe prophylaxis. For example, if funding were devoted for the rapid development of a micro-based pulmonary delivery system, mortality rates would have been minuscule and the pandemic would have been lessened. Repurposing ivermectin could have been achieved very quickly at a minor expense. However, despite all the medical evidence confirming ivermectin's strong antiviral properties and its impeccable safety record when administered properly, we instead witnessed a very sophisticated government-orchestrated campaign to declare war against ivermectin and all other natural or chemical antiviral drugs. Hydroxychloroquine, HCQ, for example, was one, in favor of far more expensive, patented, and unproven experimental drugs, such as remdesivir. Unlike the U.S., other nations were eager to find older drugs to repurpose against COVID-19, protect their citizens. A Johns Hopkins University analysis offered the theory that a reason why many African countries had very few to near zero COVID fatalities was because of widespread deployment of ivermectin. In February 2020, the National Health Commission of China, for example, was the first to include hydroxychloroquine in its guidelines for treating mild, moderate, and severe SARS-2 cases. Why did the United States and most European countries, under the spell of the U.S. and the World Health Organization, fail to follow suit? Early in the pandemic, physicians in other nations where treatments were less restricted, such as in Spain and Italy, were sharing data with American physicians about treatments they found were very effective against SARS-2 virus. In addition, there was a large corpus of medical research indicating that older drugs, such as antiviral properties that had them, could be repurposed. Doctors who started to prescribe drugs such as ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine, along with vitamin D, vitamin C, and zinc and quercetin, observed remarkable results. In fact, unparalleled at that time. Unlike the dismal recovery and high death rates reported in hospitals and large clinics that relied upon strict isolation, quarantine, ventilator interventions, the small fringe group of physicians reported very few deaths among their patients' loads. Even those deaths reported were more often than not compounded by patients' comorbidities, poor medical facilities, and other anomalies. Very early into the pandemic, medical papers were showing that ivermectin was a highly effective drug to treat SARS-2 infections. In April 2020, less than a month after the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic, Australian researchers at the Peter Daltrey Institute of Infection and Immunity had published a scientific paper. Quote, "The FDA-approved drug ivermectin inhibits the replication of SARS-2 virus in vitro," end quote. Monash University's Biomedical Discovery Institute in Australia had also published an early peer review study that ivermectin destroyed SARS-2 infected cell cultures by 99.8% within 48 hours. What was the outcome? No government health officials paid any attention. Why? As of June 2023, a database for all reports investigating ivermectin against COVID infections records 209 studies, 161 peer-reviewed, and 98 involving control groups reporting an average 67% improvement for early infections and 85% average success rate for use of a prophylaxis to prevent COVID symptoms. Moreover, prescribing ivermectin reduced death by 50% compared to remdesivir at 12%. An Italian study observed a 416% increase in hepaticocellular injury among hospital patients treated with remdesivir. Even the World Health Organization released a, quote, "conditional recognition against the use of remdesivir in hospitalized patients, regardless of disease severity, as there is currently no evidence that remdesivir improves survival and other outcomes in these patients," end quote. So here is a question. When they were condemning in the media ivermectin and any other natural treatment or non-toxic treatment, when did you hear them condemn remdesivir, Anthony Fauci's supported drug, for being a failure? You didn't. It didn't happen. Although the science shows that hydroxychloroquine should not be prescribed for late-stage COVID infections, it is highly effective as a very early-stage treatment with a 62% improvement rate and a 72% reduction in death. I repeat, 72% reduction in death. These rates are far superior to those shown for remdesivir or any FDA-approved emergency use authorization drugs. One study of 885 patients treated with hydroxychloroquine, along with azithromycin, an antibiotic, and zinc, a mineral, were shown that in less than 3 days, they were relieved of their symptoms, and none, not a single one, of 855 patients were hospitalized. None of them required ventilation, and no one died. Another study published in the journal Clinical and Translational Science reported 73% reduction in hospitalization with no serious adverse events. Regarding Pfizer's novel COVID-19 drug Paxlovid, the verdict remains open. The company does not permit independent random controlled trials to investigate its drug. Therefore, we only have Pfizer's own data to rely upon. Nevertheless, The Lancet published a study by a team of Chinese scientists at Shanghai Tong School of Medicine that managed to look at Paxlovid's use among critically ill patients hospitalized with COVID-19. The study reported 27% higher risk of infection progression, a 67% increase risk in requiring ventilation, and a 10% longer stays in the ICU facilities. Although the emergency use authorization amendment provides some protections to authorized drug and vaccine manufacturers, it was the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, PREP, in 2005 that expanded liability protections. In addition to protecting private corporations, PrEP also shields company executives and employees from claims of personal injury or death resulting from the administration of authorized countermeasures. The only exceptions for liability, and this is important for the lawyers listening, for those who have been injured, I repeat, the only exceptions for liability are if the company or its executive officers are proven to have engaged in intentional or criminal misconduct with conscious disregard for the rights and safety of those taking their drugs and vaccines. During the pandemic, the FDA issued widespread emergency use authorizations with liability immunity for the PCR, a diagnostic kit, for SARS-2, the NRA vaccines, and anti-COVID drugs such as remdesivir and Paxlovid. Even the PCR test failed to go through a robust evaluation to determine whether it could accurately predict a SARS infection. Curiously, the Secretary of the Department of Health and Human Services invoked the PREP Act on February 4th, 2020, giving liability protections. Hold on. This was over a month before the pandemic was officially announced, which raises legitimate questions about prior planning before the viral outbreak in Wuhan, China. So I have a simple question. Why would they give identification to the people in the field when they haven't yet declared a pandemic? From the pandemic's outset, Fauci embarked on the media circuit to promise Americans that federal health agencies were doing everything within their means to get a vaccine on the market because there was no available drug to clear SARS-2 virus infections. As we have seen with respect to ivermectin alone, this was patently false. Rather, the government placed an overriding emphasis on vaccination with a near total disregard for implementing very simple preventative measures to inhibit infections from progressing. Once mass vaccinations were underway, we were promised that the SARS-2 virus would be defeated and life would return to normal. Remember what you were told? Get the vaccine, you will not get the virus. Get the vaccine, you will not spread a virus. Get the vaccine, you won't get sick and go to the hospital. Get the vaccine, you won't die. All that was untrue. In retrospect, we can look back and state with a degree of certainty that American health authorities and these products' corporate manufacturers may have violated almost every emergency use authorization requirement for awarding the emergency use authorizations. Everything that went wrong when you look at the PCR kits, the experimental RNA vaccines, novel drugs, could have been avoided if the government had diligently repurposed effective and safe measures as pandemic countermeasures. Very likely, in the United States, hundreds of thousands of lives would have been saved and millions worldwide. Shortly after the pandemic was formally announced and with promising treatments in sight, the FDA recommended hydroxychloroquine, but then quickly reversed its decision in June after Fauci publicly announced the future arrival of Gilead's novel drug, remdesivir. The FDA's approval of remdesivir baffled many scientists, according to the journal Science, who were keeping a close watch on the drug's clinical reports about a, quote, disproportionality, high number of reports of liver and kidney problems, end quote. Similarly, the FDA issued a warning statement against the use of ivermectin. Although Merck was ivermectin's manufacturer, the company discredited its own product. Shortly after ridiculing its drug, the Alliance for Natural Health reported, quote, Merck announced positive results from a clinical trial on a new drug and in eliminating the virus in infected patients, end quote. Well, this new drug has a poor efficacy rate across the board, including viral clearance recovery and hospitalizations and death, 68%, by the way, on deaths and hospitalizations. And one trial funded by Merck concluded the drug had no clinical benefit. More worrisome, this drug was found to potentially contribute to lethal mutations in the RNA viruses. The drug also has life-threatening adverse effects, including mutagenic risk to human DNA and mitochondrial, carcinogenic activity, and embryonic death. And still, the FDA considers these novel patented drugs to be superior to ivermectin. Favoring a vaccine regime and government-controlled surveillance measures to track every American's movements, American health officials blatantly neglected their own pandemic policies and severe health consequences, ineffective lockdowns, deadly lockdowns, masks, social isolation, unsound critical care interventions such as relying upon ventilators, and the sole emergency use authorization approvals of the costly and insufficiently effective drugs brought about nightmares for tens of millions of adults and children. Again, the FDA worked in concert with the pharmaceutical industry to increase profit and revenues rather than improve human health and assure patient safety. This was all undertaken under Fauci's watch and the heads of the U.S. health agencies in direct violation of the emergency use authorization requirements to only authorize drugs and medical interventions when no other safe and effective alternative is available. But they were available. As we have seen, alternatives were available, and these were well known throughout the government health agencies. Instead of acting upon them and awarding emergency use authorizations to hydroxychloroquine and ivermectin and other potential off-patent drugs, the government preferred to submit to their pharmaceutical masters' demands and the financial mills that feed the CDC and the FDA bank accounts. The three-year history of the pandemic highlights a sharp distinction between dependable medical research and pseudoscientific fraud. We witnessed the CDC adopting a common Soviet-era practice to redefine the very definition of a vaccine and the parameters of vaccine efficacy in order to fit their economic and ideological agendas. This explains Washington's frequent uninformed decisions and its aggressive public relations endeavors to silence medical opponents. According to cardiologist Dr. Michael Goodkin's private investigations, several of the most cited studies discrediting ivermectin's antiviral benefits were funded by the National Institutes of Health and Bill Gates, and intentionally manipulated in order to produce fake results. That's what he is alleging. These studies were widely distributed to the AMA, the American College of Physicians, and across mainstream media to author, quote, hit pieces to demonize ivermectin. The government's belligerent and reactive diatribes, brazenly or casually advocating for censorship, were direct violations of scientific and medical integrity and contributed nothing towards developing constructive policies for handling a pandemic with a minimal cost to life. The consequence has been less informed and grossly naive public, which was gaslighted into believing lies. And where was the informed consent? Where was the informed consent that shows that the when they were giving the PCR test, they were giving it at too high replications? It was junk, meaningless. Where is the informed consent in all the schools and people lining up to get their vaccines? Were you told about the side effects? Neither the vaccine nor the drugs warranted emergency use authorization because effective and safe alternatives were readily available. No doubt a congressional investigation would uncover criminal misconduct, in our opinion. And this misconduct and conscious fraud have contributed to numerous unnecessary medically induced injuries and deaths. Moreover, these violations of the PREP Act may have the potential to lead directly to medical crimes against humanity, as outlined in the Nuremberg Code. Between 1946 and 1947, Nazi medical doctors were tried in Nuremberg, known as the Doctor's Trial. The court found 16 of 23 doctors guilty of human experimentation that involved conducting experiments with lethal drugs and substances, sterilization, forced euthanasia, and other heinous acts. These medical atrocities were conducted on some of the most vulnerable populations. Seven Nazi doctors were executed by hanging. What became known as the Nuremberg Code after the tribunal is not, unfortunately, a legally binding document. However, it has held significant ethical and historical importance for medical research and human experimentation. The Nuremberg Code is regarded as a milestone in the development of international criminal law. It has informed international and domestic guidelines and regulations on human subjects, and many countries have implemented legal and ethical frameworks inspired by the code to regulate their medical research and protect their citizens from medical abuse. Now, despite serving as the baseline for modern medical ethics, it is unfortunate that no binding international treaty or declaration has been specifically initiated that directly abides by all the Nuremberg's obligations, nor has the Nuremberg Code been officially adopted in its entirety as law by any nation or major medical association. On the other hand, other international treaties, such as the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the World Medical Association Declaration of Helsinki, which is not legally binding, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the ICCPR, and the International Ethical Guidelines for Biomedical Research on Human Rights Subjects incorporate some of Nuremberg's main principles that aim to protect people from unethical and forced medical research. Now, the United States signed the ICCPR As an international party, the U.S. Senate never ratified it. The ICCPR Article 7 clearly states, quote, "No one shall be subject to torture or cruel, inhumane, or degrading treatment or punishment," end quote, which can legally be interpreted to include forced medical experimentation, implied as cruel, inhumane treatment. Other ICCPR Articles 6 and 17 are also applicable to medical experimentation to ensure ethical conduct, obtaining proper informed consent, and the rights to life and privacy. So I have a question again. Of all the people given the vaccine, how many were senior citizens in nursing homes, assisted living centers, and were told they must take the vaccine, even if they opposed? Think of all the coercion that occurred to get people to be vaccinated or to have, in a sense, a vaccine apartheid nation. Punished if you didn't take the vaccine, rewarded if you did. That mandate impacts everyone who participated, because you're dealing with an experimental, dangerous vaccine, and that has ruined families and livelihoods. The United States is also a signatory to the Helsinki Declaration, which, although not directly aligned with Nuremberg, shares much in common. The declaration also shares some common features with the Emergency Youth Authorization Amendment and the PREP Act. These include voluntary informed consent, which is universally accepted, adequate risk and benefit information about medical interventions, and an emphasis on the principle of medical benevolence, meaning promoting well-being, and the Hippocratic rule of doing no harm. It also guarantees protections for vulnerable groups, especially pregnant women and children, which the United States government and the vaccine makers directly violated by conducting trials on these groups with full knowledge about their vaccine's adverse events in adults and developing fetus and children. In addition, weighing the scientific evidence to assess the risk-benefit ratios between prescribing ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine over Pfizer, Merck's, and Gilead's novel experimental drugs conclusively favors the former. This alone directly violates the ethical medical principles we've noted. However, in conclusion, the failure to repurpose life-saving drugs is less criminal than the motivation behind it to make room for a new generation of genetically engineered vaccines that never before have been adequately researched in human trials for long-term safety. This mass experimentation, which continues to threaten the health and well-being of millions of people, is global and can legally be interpreted under the Nuremberg Code as a genocidal attack on humanity. If the emerging data for increased injuries and deaths due to the COVID-19 vaccines is reliable, and we believe it is, the handling of the pandemic can be regarded as the largest medical crime in human history. In time, and with shifting political allegiances and public demands to hold our leaders in government and private industry accountable, the architects of this medical war against civilization will be brought to justice. I'm Gary Knoll. I'm going to thank everyone for listening. We're going to say goodbye to WBI. They're going away to the news. And we're going to go to the top of the hour. If you would like to comment on this, please call us at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. Now, I'm going to ask in the studio, the moment someone calls in, we'd like to hear from you. And it's interesting because we have a clip. I'm not going to play it today, but we have a clip where Dr. Lewinsky, who runs the CDC, is being challenged about her earlier statements and what she knew by Representative Jim Jordan in the House Oversight Committee. And he's saying, "Did you say this?" And of course, there's the video of her saying, you know, "Get the vaccine, it's safe, you know, it's effective." It was not shown to be either at that time. To the contrary, what we now have that we didn't have before We have hundreds of thousands of documents from the manufacturers of the vaccine that are being read and analyzed by about 3,500 individuals who volunteered to work with a group headed by Dr. Naomi Wolf. And they're looking at what did the manufacturer know, when did they know it, and did they say that these things would likely be a side effect, or did they deny them? Well, they denied them. And as a result, all the people after that denied that there was anything other than a safe and effective route out. Do you remember when Dr. Lewinsky said we have a pandemic of the unvaccinated? That was never true. And in fact, now virtually every study coming out shows that we have the unvaccinated who made the right choice and the vaccinated did not. When they said it provided protection, well, by what measure? For a period of time, they said, well, get this and you're going to be protected. Now we found out that natural immunity, being infected, can give you, at this moment, 16 years of protection. And it's not toxic. And then we never had a pandemic that challenged children, infants, babies, and yet aggressive pushing a vaccine on this very vulnerable group. And now we're seeing, I'm sure you've all seen, a very high incidence of previously rare would be a top athlete dropping dead. And now we have them on a regular basis and other people in other areas of life as well. And now we have this huge spike in cause of death unknown. People dying, but they don't know why they're dying. And these are people that shouldn't be dying. And these are not people with comorbidities. And so that's a whole new wrinkle to this. Only when they acknowledge that this is probably from the vaccines will we see anything done about it. I don't see any calls up, so let me also mention that I'll be doing other articles on different aspects. In case you want to be informed, you will at least have the documentation that is non-political, non-ideological. It's not swayed. No one's putting a finger on the scale of truth. You're getting the best information we can when we post it, all of our references. We don't use any blind stories or government sources. We use known sources. They don't identify, they don't get into the article. Thank you all for listening. Have a nice day.